From the home of the codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the May 2015 edition of the Bletchley Park podcast, remembering VE Day. This month we bring you Bletchley Park veterans remembering how they felt as the war in Europe ended, how they celebrated and commemorated those who didn't come home, and crucially what they did next. We'll also bring you an exciting update from the director of the hit ITV drama The Bletchley Circle, Sarah Harding, on her journey of discovery of her mother's memories of working at Bletchley Park. And I'll tell you what's on the calendar over the next few weeks, including a fascinating talk on London's first air war and special activities for kids laid on this half term. But first, you can now explore an exhibition taking you behind the scenes of the much-needed £8 million Phase 1 restoration of Bletchley Park. We can take you even further behind the scenes with the man whose camera gave him unique access to every stage of this transformation. Bletchley Park's official photographer, Sean Armstrong's images tell the story of the project, from buildings that were ready to fall down through the intricate and extensive work they needed to become part of this vibrant visitor attraction. Podcast producer Mark Cotton sat down for a chat with Sean.
For me, one of the best features of the new Hut 12 exhibition is the way the story of the renovation's told. That's told really by the photographs that Sean Armstrong, the official Bletchley Park photographer, took. I guess this was quite a unique process, wasn't it, for you?
Yeah, it was, because normally all of the work I do with Bletchley has been covering a specific event, a one-off visit or something important, or going round and taking my time to tell the story of what Bletchley offers as a heritage attraction, whereas this was a constantly changing set of unique work with the huts, with the blocks, that was quite involved. And to actually see that transform from a building site to the restored spaces that there are now was a unique process. And every time I went, something was different. Different people were in doing different jobs and skills, and rapidly changing. But as soon as it had gone, it had gone. Replacing the windows was a key feature, and then suddenly they're all back again, and now no one will ever know. So being able to record those many varied processes was a pleasure, and I was given quite unique access to dibble around in various spaces and when things were happening, huts with no floors, and seeing what was underneath before they put down the reclaimed floors again. And these were things that, besides the actual builders there, not many people actually would have seen them, which is quite cool.
That was one of the things that I thought, it's quite an honour, really. At the same time with the podcast, we're trying to tell the story, but there's only so much that we could tell through talking to people. The image did have to tell the story, didn't it? You had that unique advantage of being there. You did some bizarre things as well, didn't you?
Because when they restored both the huts and the blocks, scaffolding went up around both spaces. I mean, particularly with the huts, they were totally enclosed in order to give a sort of weather protected bubble, because they were changing the roofs and there was a lot of stuff to remove, and the new felt and the like being put down. So to be able to get up and above these spaces and get different perspectives, not only whilst they were doing the work, but also seeing the park from a different perspective, again, is something that won't be often repeated. Even one of the last things to be restored, I think the week before the royal opening, was the clock tower. It's a very, as you know, a very sort of iconic clock tower right by the stable yard, which hadn't been repaired for years. And now it's all sort of spruced up, and that had scaffolding right to the very top. And to be able to get right to the top of that scaffolding next to the, it's like a sort of Pegasus weather vane on the top, and get right up close to that and take a bird's eye view of the park. Probably most of the people that worked there during World War II never actually got up there, because there was never any scaffolding there. And getting inside and around the spaces as they changed, having seen them before they were restored as well, or just sort of dingy, dirty, unloved spaces. It's an amazing transformation.
I think everyone who's been involved says that, because it literally is. I mean, yeah. We saw the plans and we thought, yeah, that'll look great. The back of your mind, you're always thinking, how are they going to change this into this? It went beyond what you could imagine it was going to be. Especially like the huts, they were in such a poor state, weren't they?
They were, and I think the unusual thing for me was, normally when there's a new building or something going up, it's from the ground up. Get rid of as much as you can get rid of and just build something else fresh. Whereas the thread of the challenge that I saw and documented throughout the huts and the blocks was, now everything we take away, we have to look at, and we only take away what we need to take away. So there's this constant, can we leave that? No, right, we have to take it away. Can we? Well, yeah, we can patch it up. It's still a bowed wall in a hut, or it's something that on the face of it looks like it's in a state of disrepair.
That's why it's rescued and restored, isn't it?
Yeah, no, exactly. But that fine balance of taking it back to how it was, with as much retention of materials and fittings as it was, and still have it safe as a 21st century visitor attraction with disabled, elderly people, children, families, particularly the huts, going through it to get a sense of what it was like to be there when it wasn't designed with any of those thoughts in mind. It wasn't designed as a visitor attraction.
It wasn't designed to still be up now, was it?
No. And, you know, I think a few years ago, Hut 8 was restored, and I think that was done in a much more, let's just build a hut that someone could go in and out of without really looking at the paint sampling. In the huts there, the walls joined with a certain profiled tape. And if you go round and look, you can see there's a slight profiling, like this little three ridges in the tape that was used to tape the boards together to make the walls. And they tried to find that exact tape, and they couldn't, but they used a similar tape. So that's the trick. If you go around, you can, if it's got sort of three ridges down the middle, it's original, and if it hasn't, then it was replaced.
So that's the details, that a photographer would spot, probably. I probably wouldn't notice that.
Well, no, and
does
then
it sound the same?
It does. And then the process of it being, it was sort of, you know, falling down, stripped back, built back again, painted, and then distressed again to make it look old. You know, and I've got images of the various sort of set dressers, painters. You know, the doors have been painted, and then they had to go along and chipped and patinaed and made dirty. And, okay, you could go, oh, that's not how it was. But it's to give the look and the feel, and you have to go through that build-it-up-and-knock-it-back process as opposed to it being shiny doors and, you know, shiny fittings. To give that sense of, you know, the smoke would have gone up into the corners of the rooms and dirty hands around light switches and little details like that, which, yes, they are recreated, but they are only done in balance with keeping everything else that could have been kept.
I think some of those fully set dressed rooms you walk into, you can imagine that the shift has just changed and you're just waiting for the new shift to come in, and it could be, you know, summer 1941.
Yeah.
They've just nipped out the room.
Yeah, definitely. And also, you've got to make sure that all the wires and all the electrics and all the heating and everything is still fit for purpose, because I pretty much don't think it was, particularly the heating, you know, stories of how they were either...
Wood burners in the middle of the room,
You know, screamingly hot or freezing cold, and the freezing cold and drafty element obviously leads back to what they found, you know, stuffed in the roof, which is a core part of the Hut 12 exhibition, you know, bits of code-breaking paperwork and ephemera that didn't get destroyed in the big destruction phase or squirreled away, and then stuck in a rafter to stop a draft.
Well, the only known...
Yeah, the only known Banbury sheet, which, you know, you can see and features on next year's calendar, which we've just finished. He says, a little crossover.
Hot off the press.
Hot off the press, yeah. We just finished the new calendar, Bletchley Park Club, for next year. Bit more of a sort of slightly abstract artistic take. And one of the images is an image of this particular Banbury sheet, because it's quite patterny and quite old-looking. And, fascinating.
The exhibition Bletchley Park Rescued and Restored is now open in Hut 12. Sarah Harding is a woman who's been on a journey of discovery. She directed series 2 of the hit ITV drama The Bletchley Circle. By complete coincidence, her mother, Dorothy Harding, née Thompson, was a wireless operator at Bletchley Park from 1943 to 1945. Sarah has early memories of being taught how to spell her name in Morse code. Once she began to delve into the Bletchley Park story for professional purposes, her fascination and admiration for her mother's contribution naturally grew, and she followed up with our archivist and curator, discovering again by stumbling across it that her mother had written a memoir of her life, including her secret war work, opened up swathes of information she might not have otherwise extracted from her mother's now ailing memory. Sarah became one of 2014's speakers in the Bletchley Park Presents lecture series, and after her talk, she and her sister, Gillian, sat down with podcast producer Mark Cotton to catch up.
We've got a return visitor come back to see us today. It's Sarah Harding, director of the Bletchley Circle, and you've also got your sister with you.
Gillian, my sister, has come to Bletchley with me to hear the talk that you invited me to give on the Bletchley Circle and my mother's experience.
Did your sister do good?
My sister did fantastically, yes. I'm very proud of her, and it's so nice that she got the memoirs and was able to share it with lots of people here come to hear the history of Bletchley, and obviously Mum was a key part of that, and Mum would be very proud of her too if she'd seen it.
Because that's the big change since we last spoke to you. You've had a discovery.
Yes, it was really exciting because, you know, when I last spoke to you, I was busy doing the drama, the Bletchley Circle, and this certainly made me very curious. So I talked to the archive and they wanted to find out any information I could get from my mum. So I was sitting there chatting away and saying, come on, Mum, what do you remember? And it was coming out as rather muddled fragments of memory. And then my dad was listening to this and he said, I don't know why you're tiring her. She's written it all down, you know. I said, what? He said, well, she's been writing a memoir of her life. In the 90s, she typed it all out from childhood to motherhood.
And this was the first time you'd heard about it?
She used to call it Dottie's Jottings. and so I thought she'd started something and not finished it. Then I realised there was a lot of pages, about, I don't know, I'd have thought 80 typed pages.
Wow.
Of which 18 pages were about the wartime, were about all the signals training. So all the questions I was asking were there. The difficulty was getting her to let me read the memoir because it was a personal memoir. She'd written, you know, for posterity rather than publication.
Hmm.
But she realised how important getting information for Bletchley was and agreed to donate those pages or to keep a copy of those pages to the archive.
That's wonderful.
Which was very kind of her. And I think, you know, rather wonderful to read it and get a completely different insight. So it was fantastic that it came to light.
I think I remember a while ago, we didn't have sort of personal computers so much, but I think Mum tried to sort of do it on the computer and then sort of gave up. But so that would have been a lot of effort to actually physically type and keep it sort of neat. Yeah, so 80 pages.
It's just serendipity, isn't it? It's this bizarre link of events that's happened that's brought you to this, isn't it?
Well, the serendipity of, yes, I mean, getting the script led me to research, which led to the role of honour, to her badge. Then doing the programme led to the memoir coming to light. And, you know, it would be awful to have kind of just not known it was there.
And now you know more and more about your mum's life. It's come sort of full circle, hasn't it?
Yeah.
You've gone from a script to a memoir.
And then there's a moment where the memoir pushed me back to Bletchley Circle because I rather enjoyed the bit where she was complaining about the male technicians who sat in the other room, and apparently they were doing things with dials and didn't like being interrupted. So she said, oh, by the time I was a sergeant, I could sort out most things unless it was damaged. And there was a scene we had shot in 1944 where a woman decided to repair the machine herself rather than call for the male technician. And that's not actually in the Bletchley Circle. We shot it. It didn't make the cut. But I just thought that really is, you know, mirroring her experience.
Well, so that's how we've learned things here at Bletchley, is having veterans on tours going, no, you didn't used to do that. This is how we used to do it. And it comes back. It's literally, it's like, you know, they're back in 1942 or 43.
Yeah, I'm very sorry that she's not well enough to come here. All I know is that, you know, even though she's not here, Bletchley is very much inside her. And when she talks about it, it is a very happy place for her to be.
Does it bring her alive when she talks about it?
her eyes sparkle when she talks about it, yes. And then she gets excited, and then it is quite tiring because a whole flood of memories come in. But no, it's very exciting to listen to her reminisce.
Yeah, I mean, I was with her just earlier this week, and I said, you know, be coming up here, and again, like I said, her eyes sort of lit up, and we, I said, do you want to come? Well, no, because those moments are so precious, and I just want to remember it as is.
I think that's the thing, isn't it? Some of the veterans, they just want to keep their memories of when they were here. Some of them for, you know, reasons that, you know, they didn't have a good time here. But like your mum, it sounds like she had a good time here, you know, and they're good memories, and she wants to keep those good memories.
I think she genuinely did have a good time, because this isn't written for publication. This is her telling it as it is, as it was, and the fun. And, you know, it's not technical. It's really about her feelings towards Bletchley, what she did, her fun, the friendships.
I mean, that's what we try to capture when we interview the veterans for the podcast. I mean, the official oral history, that is your technical, this is when I served, this is my training, this is when I did this. What we try and capture with the podcast is the fun things, the social things, you know, the real things that affected those, what were just young girls, really, when they came here. You know, some of them came straight from school, some of them were conscripted at 19, others felt they had a duty and joined up as soon as they could. But they were all young girls.
Yeah. Oh, Mum was, 20 when she was a sergeant, 19 when she volunteered. And I know there were ones even younger than that. I think when I was reading it, whoa, I thought I'd quite like to have been at that sergeant's mess where they were having drunken parties, a lot of good pianists, good conversation, plenty of drink, a lot of fun, and all the officers angling for invitations. It sounds like, you know, quite a good time.
I think we forget sometimes that this distant part of history, you know, this big massive conflict that involved the entire world, was happening to real people's lives. So they still fell in love with people and had friendships and had enemies, and they wanted to live their lives, and they didn't know from one day to the next whether they'd still be around.
No, I think that's very true. But I also think for women, this sense of being given a proper job to do,
yes,
you know, was pretty powerful, because not many women had kind of jobs that used their intellect. I mean, spinsters, all the school teachers happened to be spinsters, or women who hadn't found partners after the First World War, the group of singles. But the idea was still, you knew your place, you found a husband, you had a family. And for them all to be kind of liberated by work and have a sense of purposefulness, I think that must have been a great discovery.
I think that was one of the things that so abundantly came through in the Bletchley Circle, the fact that after the war they'd had this freedom and then they had to go back to their dull, boring lives that they were expected to have.
But life had changed, but the unfortunate thing is it took decades for it to kind of come, and it was the next generation that profited, not them.
Like you've said to us, you in a way feel that your life was on the back of what your mum had fought for, really, wasn't it?
And hopefully my daughter's life on the back of what we fought. Yeah. I mean, that's what you try and do, is make it better for the next generation, don't you? Or fairer.
Definitely.
If you can.
You said your mum was saying about the hurts. I thought that was really nice.
My mum's 91 and she lives near Bristol. And when she speaks of the wartime years, a light comes into her eyes. And recently she was reminiscing about her time there and she fell into a reverie. An hour later she said to me, I can see the hut clearly, it's all in front of my eyes. I can't leave Bletchley. Is it a happy place, Mum? I asked. Oh yes, she said. Then I said, so why don't you stay there for a while?
Air raids on London by Zeppelin airships were expected from the moment war was declared in 1914. Early precautions included blackouts and guns being put on prominent buildings and in the parks. When the raids finally began at the end of May 1915, there were mixed responses from Londoners, from blasé to blind panic. On Sunday the 17th of May, the author of London's First Air War, Jerry White, will give a talk as part of the prestigious Bletchley Park Presents lecture series. The last few tickets are on sale in the Bletchley Park shop, and you can buy them online too. Go to bletchleypark.org.uk for more details on upcoming events. Next month's speaker is historian, best-selling author and TV presenter Taylor Downing, who'll examine the scientific successes and legacies of the First World War. This is all building up to the opening of a major new World War I exhibition in the Block C Visitor Centre at Bletchley Park. This new exhibition will take you back 100 years to the days before codebreaking was a joint effort, when there were two very separate departments working amid great secrecy, including secrecy from each other. Special activities for children will be laid on every day of the school holidays at no extra charge at Bletchley Park. Starting in May half term and running throughout the summer holidays, Bright Sparks at Bletchley Park gives the whole family the chance to explore codebreaking, World War II and e-safety. There are different activities each day, including craft and spy workshops for all age groups, children's guided tours, trails, quizzes and handling collections. This is learning by stealth because it's fun. We weren't the heroes were dead. It's a somber note to strike, but that's how bomb-wren Dot Tuffin remembers the VE Day celebrations in 1945. She's one of an ever-growing number of veterans who shared their memories of the end of the war in Europe with the Bletchley Park podcast since it began in 2012. For many of those working at Bletchley Park and its outstations, the war didn't end on VE Day, and they were moved on to the job of Japanese code-breaking. For everyone who signed the Official Secrets Act and kept Stumm for another 30 years at the very least, the war didn't even end when peace was finally declared around the world. We've been lucky enough to capture precious memories of our veterans for nearly 3 years now, so let's delve into the archive for some recollections of VE Day and what came next.
I forget to do. This is the BBC Home Service. We're interrupting programmes to make the following announcement. It is understood that in accordance with arrangements between the three great powers, an official announcement will be broadcast by the Prime Minister at 3 o'clock tomorrow, Tuesday afternoon, the 8th of May.
Well, I was a bomb operator at Eastcote on Sea Watch. Sea Watch was actually on duty when they announced VE Day.
Yesterday morning at 2:41 a.m. at General Eisenhower's headquarters, General Jodl, the representative of the German High Command, and of Grand Admiral Dönitz, the designated head of the German state, signed the act of unconditional surrender of all German land, sea, and air forces in Europe to the Allied Expeditionary Force. Hostilities will end officially at 1 minute after midnight tonight, Tuesday, the 8th of May. But in the interests of saving lives, the ceasefire began yesterday to be sounded all along the fronts, and our dear Channel Islands are also to be freed today. The Germans are still in places resisting the Russian troops, but should they continue to do so after midnight, they will, of course, deprive themselves of the protection of the laws of war and will be attacked from all quarters by the Allied troops. It is not surprising that on such long fronts and in the existing disorder of the enemy, the commands of the German High Command should not in every case have been obeyed immediately. This does not, in our opinion, with the best military advice at our disposal, constitute any reason for withholding from the nation the facts communicated to us by General Eisenhower of the unconditional surrender already signed at Reims, nor should it prevent us from celebrating today and tomorrow, Wednesday, as Victory in Europe Day.
So it stopped the following day. The chief officer gave us all a little pep talk. Well, I think she thought we were all going to lose our honour because of everybody feeling free and throwing away caution to the winds and celebrating and drinking. She was, oh, woman, it's been terrible for her. And we all rushed up to London and throwing the crowds there outside the palace, shouting and marching them down Piccadilly with about 20 Canadian Air Force officers all arm in arm. Had a marvellous day. And then we slept in the YWCA Baker Street, which we always did. Came back to Eastcote the next day. And it must have been the following day then that we then sat outside. There was a heat wave. Sat outside and smashed up the bombs. Well, didn't actually smash them. The Air Force boys, who were GCHQ engineers, they had dismantled the big things and we had all the small stuff and all these hundreds of drums to take them apart. Everything was counted, screws and bearings and so on.
Did that make you feel, oh, what have we been doing?
No, that made we were all happy. That was it, it was the end of it.
This is a solemn but glorious hour. I wish that Franklin D. Roosevelt had lived to see this day. General Eisenhower informs me that the forces of Germany have surrendered to the United Nations. The flags of freedom fly all over Europe. For this victory, we join in offering our thanks to the Providence which has guided and sustained us through the dark days of adversity and into light. Much remains to be done. The victory won in the West must now be won in the East. The whole world must be cleansed of the evil from which half the world has been freed.
And now, oh, what wonderful luck. At this moment, how wonderful Mr. Churchill has come out onto the Ministry of Health balcony. Now Mr. Churchill stands on the balcony of the Ministry of Health. He's wearing his boiler suit, the famous boiler suit that he's made so wonderful. And he had the audacity, shall I say, to put on his head his famous black hat. Nobody can say that it goes with a boiler suit, but you heard what a cheer it raised from the crowd. He stands now in the floodlights and he's giving the victory sign for all his might from the flooded balcony.
Oh, we used to have fun, we did. I mean, most of the chaps that were there had done years in Italy and had come back and were really then working up to demob. So it wasn't a very dark time. I suppose it was for the beginning, but if you remember in 1945, well, you don't remember, but in 1945, things were definitely looking up after the invasion and it looked okay all the time then. So we began to...
Yeah.
And I remember VE night, I was in Trafalgar Square. There's a picture in there of Trafalgar Square. Well, I was in that melee on VE night.
This is your victory. Victory of the cause of freedom is every day. In all our long history, we have never seen a greater day than this. Man or woman has done their bit. Everyone has tried, none has flinched. Neither the long years, nor the dangers, nor the fierce attacks of the enemy have in any way weakened the unbending resolve of the British nation. God bless you all.
You must have been at Bletchley on VE Day as well.
Well, I was on leave, so no, I was sorry about that. I was staying with my parents.
But my father had to go up to London the following day, and we'd arranged to go to the theatre that night, my mother, father, and myself. And we did. And of course, London was absolutely seething with people very excited. And my father, who was a very quiet man and had served in both World Wars and had a terrible time in the 1914 war, and it was very unlike him, he said, "Come on, we're going down to Buckingham Palace." And we did, and that was great. So perhaps I did rather well out of that.
And now listen, the band is playing Land of Hope and Glory, and the crowd is singing. And this suddenly has become a very moving moment, for Mr. Churchill too is singing, and he is conducting the singing of this song. Will you listen, please?
The German war is therefore at an end. After years of intense preparation, Germany hurled herself on Poland at the beginning of September 1939. And in pursuance of our guarantee to Poland, and in common with the French Republic, Great Britain, the British Empire, and Commonwealth of Nations, declared war upon this foul aggression. After gallant France had been struck down, we from this island and from our united empire maintained the struggle single-handed for a whole year, until we were joined by the military might of Soviet Russia and later by the overwhelming power and resources of the United States of America. Finally, almost the whole world was combined against the evildoers who are now prostrate before us. Our gratitude to all our splendid allies goes forth from all our hearts in this island and throughout the British Empire. We may allow ourselves a brief period of rejoicing. But let us not forget for a moment the toils and efforts that lie ahead. Japan, with all her treachery and greed, remains unsubdued. The injuries she has inflicted upon Great Britain, the United States, and other countries, and her detestable cruelties, call for justice and retribution. We must now devote all our strength and resources to the completion of our tasks, both at home and abroad. Advance Britannia! Long live the cause of freedom! God save the King!
When the German war finished, I was transferred onto Japanese signals. And then I was sent to Colombo, which was Ceylon in those days, now Sri Lanka, of course, and introduced to the sub-lieutenant in the section where I was to work by the Wren officer. And I saluted him and said, "Yes, sir, no, sir," and all that sort of thing, you know. And as soon as the Wren officer left, he said, "Drop the sir, my name's Harry." And actually, we got married.
Oh, wonderful.
But we waited until the war was over and we came back home, because my family didn't know him. He was a stranger.
Oh, that's lovely, that is.
Yeah.
Oh, there's quite a few stories of people.
A lot of people got married out there. Yeah.
I don't know what they put in the water in Colombo, but there must have been something.
Your husband, when you met him first, was he in intelligence as well?
Yes, yes, yes. He had done the Japanese course in London, and I think they were sent out there and going to be sent into occupied territory to send back signals. Luckily, when they got out there, the admiral didn't know why they came out. And he didn't know quite what to do with them, so he put them into HMS Anderson, which was the forward base.
And luckily for you, you got to meet him.
Yes, yes, that's right. Yes, that was very nice. Yes, we had a very romantic time.
It didn't stop there for you. When the war finished in Europe, your paraphrasing of Japanese messages continued, didn't it?
Oh, yes, it did. It was a complete surprise because a number of us, myself included, were due to go to Delhi. Anyway, suddenly that whole exercise was cancelled. But my boss called me in and said, sorry you're not going to Delhi, but you are going to Washington, D.C., and to work in the Pentagon with the British community there. A very, very large building, the like of which I'd never seen before. 32,000 for lunch. And the Pentagon is enormous, absolutely enormous. Even the centrepiece, I believe I'm right in saying it was something like 8 acres. And when General Eisenhower had finished his duties in Europe, he came back to America and came to see us in the Pentagon in this quadrangle. He came in a tank with an entourage of soldiers and other vehicles, and we were able to see him at close quarters.
A short time ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima and destroyed its usefulness to the enemy. That bomb has more power than 20,000 tons of TNT. The Japanese began the war from the air at Pearl Harbor. They have been repaid many fold.
I remember hearing about the atom bomb. We were coming from breakfast and we had a big tank of water where we washed our utensils, as they were called, a knife, fork and spoon. And somebody came up to me and said, there's been a big new bomb just dropped, you know. And that was the beginning of the atomic age. I remember that, yeah. But then VJ night, all the chaps, it was very naughty of them, the chaps who were in the men's billets, they all took the furniture out and made a bonfire of it on VJ. I think they couldn't care less then. The war was over and they thought we're PD mob. So who cares? I remember that.
It was the 15th of August, 1945. I think it was in the afternoon. Valerie and Mary and I and two other girls were on the day shift, which was rather fortunate, because Commander Williams, our superior officer, came into the room smiling and he said, well done, girls, the signal has been intercepted from Tokyo to Geneva and the Japanese are surrendering. And we just sat there in complete silence. And then Commander Williams shuffled about and then he said, well, you bloody well get on with your work now. Which broke the ice. We all laughed. And then he did say, a message has gone to the King and to the Prime Minister, and I'll come back when it's been confirmed, because it cannot be announced until Geneva has sent on the message to London, for very obvious reasons, because they would have known we'd have been listening. A handful of people at Bletchley obviously knew before it became public knowledge.
You knew before the King and the Prime Minister?
I should think about the same time. I don't think they wasted time doing that. But yes, it was a great moment. It's something that I could never tell anybody that had happened to me, obviously, because we were sworn to secrecy. But it was a great moment to feel that one must have been among the first people who knew that the war had finally ended and 6 years of our life were going to be changed. And I suppose, in a way, all the time I was at Bletchley, that was the moment that one remembers. And it's one that I've remembered all my life.
Did it seem like any sense of privilege, or was it just a sort of everything stops kind of moment?
A sense of relief, I think. After all of us who were young girls, we all knew young men who were out fighting somewhere or were prisoners, brothers, boyfriends, cousins. We all had. And it was just a wonderful moment to think that they would actually be coming home. I was billeted in Bedford then, so I think we just quietly went home on the train to Bedford. But I do remember we didn't know whether we ought to say anything, because had it been announced by the time we went off duty. But nobody said anything on the train. But perhaps all of us were thinking this, you see, we better not say anything in the train. And then when I got back to my billet there, the door was open and the landlady said, "We've just heard the war's over." I just said, "Oh, how wonderful, is it really?" But of course we stayed on at Bletchley, the work didn't finish then. We were finally released in April 1946, I think. But of course it felt different when you went into work the next day. I suppose there was an atmosphere and people were smiling, and I don't really remember, you just got on with your work.
We are gathered here, representatives of the major warring powers, to conclude a solemn agreement whereby peace may be restored. The issues involving divergent ideals and ideologies have been determined on the battlefields of the world, and hence are not for our discussion or debate. The terms and conditions upon which surrender of the Japanese imperial forces is here to be given and accepted are contained in the instrument of surrender now before you. As Supreme Commander for the Allied Powers, I announce it my firm purpose, in the tradition of the countries I represent, to proceed in the discharge of my responsibilities with justice and tolerance, while taking all necessary dispositions to ensure that the terms of surrender are fully, promptly, and faithfully complied with. I now invite the representatives of the Emperor of Japan and the Japanese government and the Japanese Imperial General Headquarters to sign the instrument of surrender at the places indicated. Let us pray that peace be now restored to the world, and that God will preserve it always. These proceedings are closed.
We couldn't get a passage back until October, but the atomic bomb was dropped on, I think it was August the 8th. But anyway, that was the end of the war, of course. But we had to wait for transport home. So it was early October before I finally left Washington for New York, where we had to wait about for the Aquitania, and I spent 3 very wet days in New York waiting to get on the boat.
But I bet you were able to bring a few things back that you couldn't get in
England. Oh, absolutely. I mean, shopping in Washington and New York after the privations of England were absolutely wonderful. We were able to buy clothes and anything else we wanted, really.
So you were a bit loaded down when you came back?
Absolutely loaded down. I had 4 cases, 2 kit bags and 2 other cases which I'd bought, and because the stevedores were on strike, I had to carry the lot, so it was 1 under each arm and 1 in each hand. Yeah, but it was a very rough crossing, actually, very rough indeed, and it took about 4 days to get back to England.
So you came back to Bletchley after you were in Washington?
Yes, that's right, but only very briefly. And, of course, it was all being run down.
So it would have been a very different atmosphere at that
very,
point.
Oh, a very different atmosphere. Rather, you know, sort of the end of a party atmosphere. There was nothing much to be done, apart from those who'd been given the job of destroying everything. So I was only there for a few days, and I was posted down to wait for my demob. I went down to somewhere in Sussex.
I think when they interviewed us, they judged us by the character they thought. If they thought we could keep a secret, then okay, you go to Bletchley Park. But if you're going to talk too much, you wouldn't get there. I mean, that was it. They wouldn't take a chance on that. I did ask one Wren officer who was interviewing for Bletchley Park and that sort of thing. I said, well, why was I sent there? I don't know. I didn't have any special qualifications. So she said, well, we thought you were a very nice girl, so you could go to Bletchley Park.
Yeah.
We didn't know what it was.
Well, no. I mean, today you've been here with three other veterans of Bletchley Park. You've all been telling a sold-out crowd what you did. You could never have imagined at 17, 18, when you joined up, that you'd be doing this 70 years later, would you?
No, no. I mean, Bletchley Park has played a very large part in my life now. And thankfully, my daughters are quite happy to help me get here. And having been presented to the Queen as well, you know, that was a very special occasion. I certainly didn't expect anything like that.
Gwendolyn, that's so kind of you to share your time with us for this interview, and I just want to thank you for your service. Thank you.
Thank you, and I'm so glad to know that people are still interested.
My parents, who died in 1970 and 71, never knew what I did here. Oh. Everybody knew about Bletchley Park. Oh, it's some foreign office place. Hush, hush. You were allowed to tell your parents that because, I mean, you know, it was a common name that people knew about. Oh, she's at Bletchley Park. Yes. Oh, hush, hush, hush. Yes, I understand, sort of thing.
How did you feel about later on when it all started to come out? I mean, it wasn't very long after your parents...
I was horrified.
Oh, really?
Absolutely horrified. I don't mind telling you. My great friend rang me up and said, have you heard? They're talking all about Bletchley. It's all over the papers. I said, what? We were told never to talk about it. I still find it extremely hard to take in that everything that was locked in my head for so long is now common knowledge. It never occurred to us that anything would be released later on.
You never felt then any sense of disappointment that you hadn't been able to tell your parents how important the job you did during the war was, because that's something that some people felt, I think.
I think they and I accepted that that was what had been laid down and they didn't ask. I suppose, yes, possibly, I was sorry that they'd both died before I could tell them. When, after they'd died, of course, everything came out. Remember my friend saying the same. Both her parents died before they knew what their daughter had done in the war.
But never the slightest temptation, by the sounds of it, on your part, to tell them.
Oh, no.
Because it was absolutely...
Mind you, possibly thinking back, we joined the Navy, we joined the Wrens, and we were under service discipline. And it would never occur to us to flout that.
What made you pick the Wrens to join? What was it about the Navy?
We liked it better than the Fannies. First aid nursing, Yeomanry, they were largely ambulance drivers. They wore car keys. And I think they were invented in the First World War.
What's your abiding memory of this place, and how does it feel to come back?
I had the time of my life here. I enjoyed myself very, very much.
Ah, the roaring Wren social scene that I've heard about.
Oh, yes, and I mean, not only the Wrens. Bletchley was like its own town. There was an incredible amount of social life going on here. There was a thriving theatre whose director was a captain in the army called Captain Malcolm Howgate, and he was always known as Milky, Cowangate. At any rate, one of my great friends was lucky enough to be accepted at an audition for a play they did there called Yes, My Darling Daughter. And the leading lady in that was a Belgian ATS sergeant called Jeanne Kamerz, whose father, subsequently after the war, I discovered, was quite a famous film producer. There were all sorts of weird people here, you know. Interesting weird people, too. The novelist Agnes Wilson, he was here with his partner, Bentley Bridgewater, and they were the nuts. But no, it was great fun. It really was. I made a lot of good friends here.
The lives of everybody that you'd ever met was completely consumed by that war for such a long time.
Well, it was 6 years, you know. It was a long time. And when you're only 19 or 20, 6 years is a long time. I wasn't at Bletchley 6 years, but for people who were, it must have been really quite hard going, knowing that you were there until the war was over. And it was this cloud of secrecy that seemed to hang over the whole park. Almost, it really was almost like a cloud. You never went into anyone's room. You always shut the door behind you immediately. And, of course, you didn't talk if you were with somebody. You didn't talk to them about anything to do with your work, ever. You couldn't. And, of course, it was sometimes rather difficult. You couldn't tell your parents. Or if you got married, you couldn't tell your husband. It was a bit strange.
Was there a moment that was particularly memorable for you, being able to tell your husband for the first time?
Ah, yes. That book was published in, well, forget the date of it.
74.
And my husband came down from London, and he'd been in Hatchards and had seen this book, which he promptly bought, because he used to always say, why can't you tell me what you did? It's ridiculous. Anyway, he came down, and he came through that door carrying this book, and he put it down in front of me and said, now, will you tell me what you did in the war? And I looked at it in absolute horror, and I said, no. But, of course, it gradually came out, and so it was obviously all right. But I never liked talking about it for years and years. It's just one didn't.
You'd locked it away, of course. And when you signed the Official Secrets Act, there was no indication that that would be lifted.
Well, we were told it was for the rest of our lives. And that was all very well for the girls, but I think for some of the men who weren't in uniform, and their families did sometimes wonder what on earth they were doing tucked away in Buckinghamshire, you know. I think it must have been very hard for them. You know, why aren't you in uniform? And yet they were probably doing something terribly special. We don't know.
I never felt at ease, even after the veil of secrecy was lifted in 1975. I had no wish to talk about it then, as I believe is the case with many others. It wasn't until about 1994 that I was encouraged to think about giving talks about Bletchley generally, and then I began to open up, but it's been quite difficult over the years.
And after over 100 talks, you can talk about it quite openly now.
Oh, that's right. I don't have any problems now.
And you had to come back into normal life. You didn't come back as a hero. The heroes were dead. You weren't the hero. You came back. You've got to get on with your life. It wasn't a make-believe world. You had to get on with it. I got £42 when I left the Wrens. My husband, who was an officer, he got 78. After we'd been home about 2.5 years, we got married. Our first home was a gaslit flat in Acton, and we had one bathroom and three lots of tenants on different floors. We all used the same bathroom, the same toilet and everything. You didn't bother to talk about it because nobody after the war was going to believe you, because this place didn't exist. Didn't exist for her husband. Yeah. And if he didn't know, there was no point. My husband only told the grandchildren over in Australia about 6 years ago, because he was D-Day tank landing craft. The grandchildren, they were there, and they said, we really want to know what your grandma was doing. And they said, yes, she was in the Wrens and she was probably a cook. And my husband said, I'll tell you what she was doing. The kids couldn't believe it. So I went up a notch. My husband would wear his medals on Armistice Day. We would hug each other and say, we were the lucky ones. We came back. A load of our boys didn't come back. It would have been lovely to have seen our boys come back to Wimpy. And it would have been lovely to have all sat down in the same office and seen the same boys there. They went home. So this is what matters, yeah.
Absolutely.
So I got a letter.
And how many years were you here for?
5 years. Anybody else would have done it if they happened to find themselves in that position.
So when you left at the end, was that
pretty much the end of activity in Bletchley at the time?
Well, yes, I suppose it probably was, but I was asked to go and learn Japanese and do the Japanese war, so I went up to London at that point and did learn Japanese and did translate Japanese. Well, it seems extraordinary when you look at these funny old things, which is us, that we actually did it, doesn't it? And they were all working incredibly hard. I mean, we regularly worked 12-hour shifts, but I worked 24-hour shift over the Bismarck thing because I just happened to get it. By today's standards, I would say we were workaholics. We were lucky enough to be here at the right time, in the right place. We were able to do what we did because of that. It may be the most important thing that any of us ever done in our lives. We didn't realise it at the time, but we do now.
We were in the Newmanry, as it was called. We were treated with not familiarity, but great respect, and that made it all very much easier. And, of course, girls are gregarious by nature, and we're all great friends. Yeah. It was like a family, and it was a crucial moment. Many girls came straight from school. As I said, I'd been to university, so I was that much older.
Mm.
But getting away from Mum and fetching the fish on Tuesday and all the stuff you do at home, you know. And there were some who were more innocent than you'd believe possible. One little 17-year-old really didn't know what men for, she said.
And did you ever sneak out and get down to London or things like that?
All the time, yes.
Did you?
Yes. The dodge was to find a stopping train and one that was followed fairly quickly by another. So you could stop at one of the little stations on the way to London, I forget what they were called, or on the way to Oxford, and you had to make sure there was another train coming along behind. You got out, you changed out of your uniform, you stuffed it in the manger, put on your glad rags, which you brought in a plastic, or the equivalent of a plastic bag, and went up to London all glamorous for your evening out. But of course it depended on being certain that on the way back the same operation could be repeated. Luckily, a lot of the officers had no idea what we got up to. And it was part of the fun, really.
And do you look back, in general, that it was fun?
I look back that it was fun, and I look back at the fact that whatever other nonsense, even if I'd been a hopeless wife and a lousy mother, there was one moment when I did something which was really useful. I did once do something valuable for my country.
Your service was invaluable, and thank you so much for your service.
Well, you know, it was lucky that we came to such an unusual and really rather sparkly place, even though we weren't allowed to see much of it. It was fun being here. The vibes were very good.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, veterans and visitors who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk, find us on iTunes and Twitter, where we are at BPark Podcast, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audio Boom, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. And if you like the Bletchley Park podcast, don't be shy, write a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.